How does a novelist make the leap from realistic fiction to dystopian fantasy? Chang Rai Lee joins us to talk about his new novel, On Such a Full Sea.
I've always had a sensitivity to class structure, and partly probably because I'm an immigrant and we came to this country, you know, as in a different class that we ended up in.
What was it that made Barbara Stanwyck such a standout actress and a true Hollywood star? Victoria Wilson is here to talk about her new biography, A Life of Barbara Stanwyck.
She got rid of her gestures and she managed to get to a very deep emotional truth.
Greg Coles has bestseller news and will tell us about what the authors of this year's 10 best books have most enjoyed reading this past year. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This episode is brought to you by BookBub, a service that helps readers discover high-quality ebooks they'll love at a great price. Go to bookbub.com/NYT to get alerts on free and discounted ebooks.
Our cover review this week is On Such a Full Sea, the new novel by Chang Rai Lee. It is reviewed by Andrew Sean Greer and the author, Chang Rai Lee, joins us now. Hi, Chang Rai.
Hi, Pamela.
So this novel is a real departure from your earlier novels, which were much more naturalistic, realistic. Tell us about how you came to write what is, I think, can be considered a dystopian fantasy.
Well, I didn't actually intend to write a dystopian novel. I had planned to write a social realist novel, actually, about China. And contemporary China and factory workers there. But after doing all the research and sitting down to write and beginning to write a little bit, I decided that I didn't quite have the right angle into that story. And I was looking about for another way to address some of the things I'd been thinking about, which was about Chinese ascendancy, but also, of course, a kind of sense of American stagnation or decline. And so I was just thinking about how to frame that story, and it occurred to me one day after being on the train from D.C. to New York that, and seeing the sort of ghetto areas that you can see from the train in East Baltimore, that perhaps those sections could be resettled and re-inhabited by foreign settlers, and specifically by Chinese settlers. But of course, setting that story in a contemporary circumstance didn't seem possible or plausible. So I thought, well, what would happen 200-300 years from now or 150 years from now? And thinking about a very different America, a very different social and economic circumstance. And that's sort of how the story came to be.
I want to go back to the story that you didn't write in a minute. But first, when you talk about that America in 150 years, what is it that characterizes it? What is the decline that you see now? How does that change over the course of the next 150 years?
Well, so much of what we've been talking about today, and Bill de Blasio was talking about yesterday, is income inequality. And something, it's this, and I think we all have a sense of the profound inequality that we see in our society today.
Yes.
You know, that the rich are so rich and that the poor seem to be entrenched in their circumstance.
And there is no one left in the middle.
With very few people left in the middle. And that the middle class has become, you know, kind of a working poor middle class, almost indentured to the kind of structure that we have economically in this form of capitalism, at least that's how we're seeing it now. And so in my book, the society is divided into three very distinct classes: a very, very rich, uber rich charter class, so called, the workers in this labor colony who are, you know, have middle class trappings to their existences, but are very regimented and regulated. And then most of the people live in what I call the open counties, which are basically just forgotten areas. Without any bureaucracy, without much infrastructure, without really any kind of oversight.
So it is contemporary realistic fiction.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, for so much of what my anxieties are. And I think that's partly what any kind of speculative or dystopian novel addresses. I mean, they address, you know, such a story addresses the writer's anxieties. And these have been mine in the last, you know, 10 years or so. Obviously, I've been working on other books, too. But I don't know, I've always had a sensitivity to class structure, and partly probably because I'm an immigrant and we came to this country, you know, as in a different class that we ended up in. But our consciousness of class was always at the fore. And so this is one of the major, I think, concerns of On Such a Full Sea.
When did your family immigrate?
They came, my father came in 1967. We came 6 months later. He was training as a resident, medical resident, in first Pittsburgh and then in Manhattan. And so as typical with families, he called for the rest of us. And so I was actually born in Seoul, Korea, but came when I was quite young.
But this novel is set primarily in Baltimore, which I'm assuming you chose originally from that train ride. But was it a challenge to write about a place where you hadn't lived, or have you spent time there?
I haven't spent much time there. You know, over the years, obviously I've seen that part of Baltimore from the train. I don't think I worried about Baltimore so much as Baltimore itself. I was trying to look at Baltimore as, well, at least that part of Baltimore, as emblematic of a certain kind of urban decay.
Yes.
And so it could have been Detroit.
Right.
It could have been Buffalo. It could have been Youngstown, Ohio. I suppose it didn't really matter exactly which town it was. But we're seeing so many articles about, particularly in your paper, about, you know, the response to this urban decay, either tearing stuff down, raising, or trying to revitalize neighborhoods. And so it's obviously still, you know, such a big issue for American cities and American society.
I want to go back just for a minute again to the novel that you didn't write, because you talked about how you originally intended the book to be to take place in China, and you actually traveled and spent some time there as part of that research.
Yeah, I did. I went to Shenzhen, and luckily I got into a factory so I could, you know, see the campus and the workers and the factory floors. And so it was a really fascinating trip. And as I mentioned, I was thinking about writing this sort of social realist novel. You know, I'd always loved, even though a lot of people don't like that book, I always loved Zola Germinal.
Oh, yeah, I love that book.
Yeah. Some people think it's a little overdone, but I always thought it sort of grabbed at my heart. And I thought, you know, I'm going to write this book about Chinese factory workers. And it was fascinating. I was able to see both the, you know, their work lives on the floor at the benches, but also behind closed doors a little bit. They showed me the dormitories where they lived. And although none of those particular details got, you know, were translated into the book as you read it now, I do think that I was able to capture some of the feeling I had walking through that place and touring and seeing the details, you know, sort of the laundry hanging in the dorm room, very crowded dorm rooms, and the real quiet and concentration and focus of the workers and their general sense of, I guess, what I would call self-willed compliance. So it was sort of the atmosphere that I got from that trip.
And what did you feel walking through?
I was just amazed. I thought that it was both very hopeful, but also very depressing. Hopeful in the sense that these were clearly, you know, all younger people, mostly women, probably most of them from the provinces, who were certainly bettering their lives, making a lot more money than they'd ever dreamed of or their parents ever had. And at the same time, it's sort of draining to watch all that humanity, I would say, kind of wrecked a little bit, at least in their souls. It felt like you could see nothing but a real effort in their faces, just to continue to do the work hour after hour after hour. And that, to me, was quite chilling.
And was that the predominant sort of feeling that you brought to the novel that you did write?
Yeah, I mean, part of it was, you know, so much of the On Such a Full Sea is about not just the adventure tale therein, but the sense of community I wanted to write a community novel in one regard, and particularly a kind of community that is self-policing, but also internally policing, you know, this kind of self-control that people have and the willingness to put themselves in situations that are unpleasurable and even negative, but continue to do it for some other reward.
You talk about a community novel. Is that why you chose, or one of the reasons why you chose to write in the collective we voice?
Absolutely, yeah. I had not known that originally. That wasn't part of my conception of the book, but...
Nothing went according to plan, it seems.
Well, I, you know, you just think, I'm going to write this novel. It's going to be set in this factory settlement. But then very early on, as I was sketching out and trying out certain voices and certain perspectives, I got onto the we, the first person plural, and it just immediately clicked in and felt right. And I understood that it's sort of, you know, sometimes that can happen in the writing where, you know, it's either a character or a perspective or an angle. And then that angle informs everything. And it informs, of course, the way I was going to tell the story, but also what I might tell in the story. You know, a story like such a dystopian story could have all been and only been an adventure tale, you know, a tale about this new world and all the little things that happen in it. But I really did want to get to the idea of a group mentality and a group ethos that was, of course, self-conflicted and I hope interesting.
Well, it seems like there's nothing more of a sure thing these days in fiction than dystopian fantasy. But as our reviewer, Andrew Sean Greer, wrote in his opening line of the review, he wrote, watching a talented writer take a risk is one of the pleasures of devoted reading, and On Such a Full Sea provides all that and more. So it sounds like these changes in your original conception ended up in a very good place. Changrai Li, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pamela.
The book is On Such a Full Sea by Changrai Li, reviewed on our cover this week by Andrew Sean Greer.
This episode is brought to you by BookBub. BookBub alerts you to free and discounted ebooks in genres that match your interests. Every book is hand-selected by BookBub's editorial experts from over 20 categories, including bestsellers, mysteries, romance, biography, science fiction, historical fiction, and nonfiction. BookBub works with the Kindle, iPad, Sony, Android, and more. BookBub subscribers have downloaded over 25 million ebooks. Sign up for BookBub for free in less than 30 seconds by entering your email address and what kind of books you like. Go to bookbub.com/NYT. That's bookbub.com/NYT to get free and discounted ebooks.
I can't do it. I have to think of myself. I've gone through a lot to get those things. My life has been bitter and hard. I'm not like other women. All the gentleness and kindness in me has been killed. All I've got are those things. Without them, I'd be nothing. I'd have to go back to what I was. No. I won't give them up.
Victoria Wilson has written the first half of a biography of Barbara Stanwyck, A Life of Barbara Stanwyck, Steel True, 1907 to 1940. She joins us now. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
So the first question, which anyone who sees this book in print will ask, which is, you know, wow, 1,044 pages of Barbara Stanwyck, and it's only the first half. Did you know going into writing the book that it would be a two-part biography?
I had absolutely no idea, and nobody in their right mind would set out to do such a thing.
And you also, as an editor, probably, which is your sort of day job, know that probably more than anyone else. But what made it merit the two-book biography, the two-book treatment?
Well, what happened was that I realized very early on that I was not interested in writing a movie star biography. And from the outset, when I started doing research and went into her past, her family past, and found out that Barbara Stanwyck instead of being just a Brooklyn girl, was indeed a daughter of the American Revolution. I mean, her family is from a very old, old New England family that was indeed involved and participated in the American Revolution. She came from the small town, or family came from the small town in Lanesville, and that I had wondered how her father became a Mason. It seems such an odd job. And I discovered that there in the middle of this peninsula of Lanesville was this quarry, and what were the stones being used for that were being carried to the huge schooners that were docked in Lane's Cove, and that they were being taken to build up all of the cities on the East Coast because it was the Industrial Revolution. And from there I went to how basically the family fell apart because, like many families of that period, they left the small towns and went to the big cities. And had this particular family not done that, it's not that she might not have been born, but she would have had a completely different life because they moved to the big city and then the mother was killed and the father ran off. And I was interested in all of the things that affected that life.
She was born Ruby Stevens, and as you mentioned, her mother died when she was only 4 years old. How did she get into show business? She started at an early age.
Well, her sister was, she had three older sisters, much older, like 18, 19, and 21 years older. And one of them was an actress and a dancer. And the sister sort of farmed Stanwyck and her older brother, who was older by 2 years, out to families around the neighborhood. And I went to PS 152 out in Brooklyn, and someone had stolen Barbara Stanwyck's school record, but her brother's was still there. And by the eighth grade, he had gone to 14 different schools. And the same was obviously true of her. And so she was farmed out, but the sister Millie took her along with her when she could to watch her work, and Stanwyck would, or Ruby Stevens would stand in the flies and watch her sister, and this world sort of became the family for her. It became like the world of comfort for her.
And you look in the book at this whole era in New York, the Roaring Twenties. Stanwyck was briefly in the Ziegfeld Follies and show business during this period. How did Stanwyck then move from that into film?
Well, what was interesting about that period when she was in, she was in a lot of reviews. She was in the Ziegfeld Follies for quite a while, but then she was in a lot of different reviews, and she ended up in a play that sort of made her, called The Noose. And then she worked with this great director, producer, Arthur Hopkins. And what was happening in this, that's another thing, that what interested me, what was happening in the theater at that point was after the Great War, the First World War, was the theater was becoming very naturalistic. I mean, it was, you know, the moment of Eugene O'Neill as the sort of quintessential figure of that time. But it was really her husband, Frank Fay, who was the great, great vaudevillian and who basically influenced everybody from George Burns and Jack Benny all the way down to Johnny Carson. All stand-up comedy today basically comes from Frank Fay. She had been approached many times to go into the movies. L.B. Mayer had approached her. Irving Thalberg had approached her. And she had absolutely no interest in Hollywood. She wanted to stay in New York because she knew it, and she was sort of a creature of habit. And she was just about to... It's interesting. She had just been offered this job, a role as the lead in this play, Machinal, that Arthur Hopkins was directing, and it was based on the life of Ruth Snyder, and 16 years later she made Double Indemnity, also based on that same life. But anyway, she really went along to Hollywood with her husband, and once she got there she hated it, and Hollywood didn't have the vaguest idea of what to do with him. They kept putting him in these movies as a Latin lover, which was the last thing he was, and anyway, so then it took off from there.
And as his career had difficulties, hers obviously began to soar. But she was really not a typical Hollywood star, even for that period. Was it noticeable to audiences and to critics then how different she was from the sort of standard glamour puss of the 30s?
Well, I think that in the early 30s, I mean, when she was sort of anathema in Hollywood. I mean, they didn't know what to do with her. And, you know, the thing that's interesting, a lot of people ask this question, which is not the question you're asking, but the thing is, why did she stay with Frank Fay, who was this, he was not a well man, and he was complicated. He was brilliant. And she learned to act, I mean, Jimmy Cagney learned to act watching Frank Fay. And as I say, you know, he influenced all of these other lives, Jack Benny and George Burns. And when I interviewed Milton Berle when he was 92, he still remembered Frank Fay's monologue from 1926. So the two of them sort of isolated themselves in Hollywood. And what people really don't understand, because at the heart of their relationship is it's about the disease of alcoholism, which I really tried to explore in this book and to show, A, how it progresses, and B, what the effects of it are. And one of them is isolationism. Together, they sort of saw themselves against all of Hollywood. But in the movies, critics saw her, I mean, she was tough. She had an explosive quality, which I think was right for the time. And in one of the movies I write about, which is an amazing movie that everybody should see, because people talk about Babyface is the outrageous movie. It is, but the really outrageous movie that's just so shocking is Night Nurse.
Babyface was 1933, and Night Nurse came out when?
Night Nurse came out in 1931. It was the point at which all of these gangster movies were having, because of what was going on in the world, and Daryl Zanuck was interested, Warner Brothers was interested in capturing those headlines and the sort of grittiness and the gutsiness of what was going on and the insanity. And it's where Public Enemy was about a bootlegger and a gangster. Night Nurse was about the effects of bootlegging on this family and this mother who is starving her children for the money. I mean, it's completely insane, but it was the first movie for Clark Gable, and it's a movie that he became a star in that movie.
What did critics say about her at the time?
Well, they said that she, you know, she always had one moment where she would explode, and they started writing that for her, and she really could deliver the goods, and she was huge. I mean, she had a size, even though she was actually quite small. That rage and that emotion, that emotional expression that she was able to get to, I think shocked people, but it affected people. And but you can't really sort of separate that out from everything that happened to her. I mean, her entire childhood was, you couldn't have a more perfect training for being in Hollywood in the way she was in Hollywood, because she was always outside of the studio system, which at that point was like the sun and the stars of the universe.
She endured a lot of trauma as a child as well. She was raped and had a botched abortion. And did she talk at all about how, in any way, about how those experiences informed her approach to acting or to these roles?
No, she didn't. I mean, I didn't find any of that. I found where she talked about, what she talked about that was interesting and that I use in the book is that she said there was nobody there to do her fighting for her. There was no mommy or daddy. I mean, if, you know, we say, okay, well, she was an orphan at four, but if you really stop and imagine or try to imagine what that feels like when you're 4 years old and you're alone, it's sort of inconceivable. She had these three sisters, but they were basically living their own lives. They were having their own families. And so everything that she experienced in her childhood trained her. I mean, at a certain point, She's 22 or 23 years old when she decides she's going to go against all of Hollywood and say, no, I want more money on my contract. And Harry Cohn says, well, you have a contract. And she says, basically, I don't care. And he took out an injunction against her. She was also under contract to Warner Brothers. And she thought, you know, I'll go off and make this picture, Safe in Hell, that she was supposed to make with William Wellman. And what did Harry Cohn do? He went to all of the studio heads. Now, this is a 23-year-old child, basically. He went to all the studio heads who all wrote affidavits saying, basically, yes, they admired her work, and no, this can't happen, and they were going to stop her from working anywhere. And she just marched right on. I mean, that takes incredible, I mean, beyond guts.
And yet, you write in the book about how very different she was, her on-screen presence, from the way she came across in everyday life. Physically, she looked very different on screen than she was perceived by those who met her in person.
Well, she was small. You know, I could never really get a clear number whether she was 5'3" or 5'5", but she was small. And as Frank Capra says about her, she was mousy. She didn't wear makeup, and Frank Faye didn't want her to wear makeup. And she didn't. She only wore lipstick. And what she said was, oh, well, my face can't accommodate makeup. It just sort of runs. Well, that was not really true anymore. I mean, she would say, she told her close friends that the reason why she couldn't have a child was because she was a bleeder. Well, if you're a bleeder, hemophiliac, you're not going to do the stunts that she did for years and years and years. I mean, yeah, I mean, if you're a hemophiliac, you're not going to be doing what she did. And it was that she'd had this abortion and couldn't have children.
These early films of Barbara Stanwyck we're talking about, you know, are now 80 years old. For listeners who have never seen a Barbara Stanwyck movie, never saw any of her later films that she's so famous for, Ball of Fire, Double Indemnity, The Lady Eve, what would you say to them about, you know, why you would want to see one of these early Barbara Stanwyck films?
Well, what's interesting about her movies is that though some of them around her may seem a little creaky, and actually they don't, she is always modern in them. She was way ahead of her time. And because she learned from these masters who didn't know that they were masters, you know, Willard Mack and Arthur Hopkins and Frank Faye and then Frank Capra, she stripped down her acting. She got rid of her gestures, and she managed to get to a very deep emotional truth in all of these movies, and at the same time be shocking, and, you know, it's an experience. It's not an experience that you stand back from. You're just there with her.
Hopefully this will send many listeners to their Netflix queues to call up some of her early films. Vicki Wilson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pamela.
That was Victoria Wilson, author of the new biography, A Life of Barbara Stanwyck, Steel True, 1907 to 1940. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. What do we have new on the list this week, or if anything?
Really, for the second week in a row, there's nothing at all on the hardcover bestseller list that's new. I can run down what some of the bestsellers are, if you want me to. Or I can just tell you that there's one new book over on the combined side of things that's on the nonfiction combined list, and it's new with an obvious movie tie-in. It's the book The Wolf of Wall Street by Jordan Belfort, new at number 8. And that is the memoir that became the Leonardo DiCaprio movie that's out right now to very strong reviews.
All right. The obvious movie tie-in. Every bookstore I went to over the vacation seemed to be selling many copies of The Goldfinch and The Bully Pulpit, both still high up on the list.
Yeah. On the hardcover list, The Goldfinch is in at number 5. And on the nonfiction side, The Bully Pulpit is also at number 5 on the hardcover. And the top-selling books in hardcover in fiction, it's John Grisham's Sycamore Row, which has just had a long run at number 1. It was at number 1 last week as well. It's been on the list for 10 weeks. And Charles Krauthammer's essay collection, Things That Matter, has also held onto its spot at number 1 in nonfiction, also for 10 weeks. And it's also at number 1 for most of that 10-week run.
And going back to The Goldfinch, you spoke to some of the authors of our 10 best books of the year, of which The Goldfinch was one, about what they're reading. What does Donna Tartt have to recommend?
Well, yeah, because it's been such a quiet time on the bestseller list, and also because with the holidays coming up and we had short work weeks, I needed to figure out what to write about for a couple of weeks in a row. And with nothing new on the list, I instead turned to the authors of our 10 best books of the year and asked them what books they'd read in the past year. It didn't need to be a 2013 book. As long as they had read it in the past year, what books had really stood out in their mind from what they'd read. 9 out of the 10 authors did get back to me with reading recommendations. The only one who did not was Kate Atkinson, the author of Life After Life. And all 9 others did. So I'll tell you what they recommended. Donna Tartt, who wrote The Goldfinch, the book that she really liked last year the most, she said, was P.G. Woodhouse, A Life in Letters, which is a collection of Woodhouse letters edited by Sophie Ratcliffe. She says she's always been a big fan of Woodhouse, and this letter collection really gives you a glimpse of kind of the man behind the author. Then we also had Sherry Fink, the author of 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. She picked a couple of different books. One was a book about the Haiti earthquake. It's Jonathan M. Katz's The Big Truck That Went By, How the World Came to Save Haiti and Left Behind a Disaster. Katz was an Associated Press reporter. He was in Haiti when the earthquake happened, and he talks about some of the bureaucratic bungling that made the disaster worse there. And then Fink also liked Charlie LaDuff's book about Detroit called Detroit, An American Autopsy, which looks at some bureaucratic failures right here at home and the fate of that iconic American city.
Both books in ways similar to her book about Katrina and the effects on a hospital in
New
Orleans.
Right. Yeah, looking at how a city or a place responds to the disaster in its midst. Then Rachel Kushner, who wrote The Flamethrowers, recommended an older book that was just re-released this year by New York Review Books Classics, and in fact, Kushner herself wrote the introduction to this book. It's by Curzio Malaparte, an Italian book called The Skin. And like The Flamethrowers, Kushner's novel, The Skin looks at America and Italy and World War II, a lot of the same subjects that she's exploring in parts of The Flamethrowers.
So she begged to write the introduction.
Yeah, she said that, you know, she's such a fan of the book that she approached New York Review and said, can I write the introduction to this book? And they said yes. Then Sonali Dharaniyagala, who wrote a book called Wave, really a devastating but beautiful book. She's not a writer by trade. She's an economist by trade. But Wave details the death of pretty much her entire family, her parents, her husband, her children, in the tsunami of 2004. And she also recommends a couple of books. The first of them does also deal with loss. It is a book by the artist Karen Green, who Dharaniyagala does not say this, but Karen Green is David Foster Wallace's widow. She's an artist, and she wrote a book called Bow Down. And it's partly prose fragments and partly collage and art, and all of it is on the theme of loss and grief, dealing with the death of a loved one. And then she also recommends an Italian book by Elena Ferrante called My Brilliant Friend. It's a novel set in Naples in the 1950s.
Everyone is talking about these Elena Ferrante novels by the mysterious.
Yeah,
she or he.
Exactly. Elena Ferrante is a pseudonym, and nobody, including apparently the publisher, so the publisher claims, knows who Ferrante really is. And it's been a mystery that's captivated Italy and is now making its way into American literary circles. Who is Elena Ferrante? So this book, My Brilliant Friend, is one of Sonali Dharanayagala's favorites from last year. Then Christopher Clark, who wrote the World War I book, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914, really liked a book dating back to 1992, a sociological study called Death Without Weeping, The Violence of Everyday Life in Brazil by Nancy Shepherd Hughes. And that looks at a poor community in northeastern Brazil and kind of the interweaving of history and society and culture. It's a kind of an expansive study, anthropological study of one small community. And then just quickly to round out our best books authors and their recommendations, last week's column, I had Chimamanda Adichie, who wrote Americana, one of our five best novels of the year. She says that this is the year that she discovered Barbara Pym. She read A Glass of Blessings this year and could not believe she'd never read Pym. She says that it somehow manages to be both prim and subversive. Then Peter Baker, New York Times reporter Peter Baker, whose book Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House, was one of our five best nonfiction. He liked Gary Bass's book, The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide, which is a book about the founding of what is now Bangladesh and the American role in that.
One of our notable books of the year.
Yes. Then George Saunders, the author of the story collection 10th of December, recommends Edmund Wilson's Patriotic Gore, which is a book of criticism, an essay collection about the literature of the Civil War. And Saunders, of course, has written about the Civil War and sort of the commercialization of the Civil War. So I was surprised to learn that he had never read Patriotic Gore before, and happy to read that he finally has and that he loved it, as he should.
Right.
It's really a great book. And then Alan S. Blinder, who wrote After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead, he really liked this past year a book from the previous year, Nate Silver's The Signal and the Noise, which is a book of statistics and how to analyze big trends to cut through all the noise and realize what really matters.
All right, then. A lot more to read. Thanks so much, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.